And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Pierce is going to share his experience in Strength and Hope. He comes from the Fifth Tradition group, but he's no stranger to this room. I see him here often. And I know he works with the newcomer, and he's got a lot to share. So please, everyone, give him a warm welcome. How about a big hand?
Biggest crowd yet. My name is Pierce Marr, and I'm an alcoholic. Before I start, I want to tell you a little funny story of what happened today. So I got off work, and I work in East Cobb. So on my way home, I saw that they had these food trucks out there. So I said, oh, let me stop it. It's right by my job. I said, I need a little something to eat before I come here because I don't know if I want to eat a big meal. Well, so I go in, and I get myself some fancy tacos off a fancy truck, right? And there's all these political signs and all these politicians wandering around, because the election's on the 31st of July. So I'm sitting there eating, right, and this guy sits down and he starts talking to me. He's running for state court or something like that. So I asked him, I said, well, what did you do before you were state court? He said, oh, he's a policeman for East Cobb. I said, well, is there a panhandling law in East Cobb? He said, there sure is. I said, well, what's between you panhandling my vote and somebody come up and asking me for money? He got up and walked away. As I said, my name is Pierce Marr, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 10th, 2010. It's an honor to be here. I see a lot of people I know here. I'm a little bit nervous, so bear with me. Where do I begin? I was born in 1962, the youngest of seven. I have two older brothers and four sisters. Between me and my oldest sister, I'm the youngest. Between me and my oldest sister is 13 years. So if you do the math, it's about 1.5 years per child. By the time I was born, my parents were just burnt out. As a child, the one thing I do remember, I really don't remember before I was 4 years old because I got hit by a car and I had a fractured skull at four. So I already, essentially had attention deficit disorder. I wasn't, never thought about, somebody was chasing me and I ran into the street and got hit by a car. Don't ask me how what happened, but it did. I got a fractured skull. So now I blame it on a closed head injury. I come from a family of alcoholics. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. You shake the family tree and bottles do fall out of it. My mother was very, very, very 24/7 alcoholic most of the time that I can remember. So my older brothers and sisters, by the time we came along, they were all coming out, they were either in the middle of high school or getting out of high school and going off to college. So then there was my mother always said she had the perfect family. She had two girls and two boys, and then there were the other three of us that came, so I don't know. So myself and two of my sisters, we, had to take care of ourselves. But my father had a job where, he could take care of us. He was one of the chiefs of police of New York City. And he, what he would do is he would, we had a finished basement in the house in the Bronx. And he would put us down there. And there was, there wasn't a TV down there, but there were toys and there was a bathroom. And there was an eye hook lock on the outside of the door. Well, what he would do is that he would go probably at the time to a local precinct or whatever, do what he had to do, and then come back and check on us in every couple hours. He did the best that he could. He tried to protect my mother, when I'm talking about a raging alcoholic, I mean, on a bender for 3 weeks in bed, screaming, asking, not screaming bad things, asking for whiskey. And, it was just the way I grew up. It was just, that was the, that was just the deep, dark family secret. That wasn't a very well-kept secret at all. Everybody knew that she was, she'd go walking to the liquor store in a mink coat and basically nothing else. And, my father, since he had so much power, he would do crazy things like go around with the picture of her and just say, if you sell this woman liquor, I'm going to shut you down. And he would. Right? The ambulance would come in the middle of the night and take her to the hospital somewhere. And so these were, the earliest memories that I have of alcohol. And, you know, it wasn't a pretty picture, that's for sure. You know, as I went to school, you know, I was, I always had to live up to, hey, you're not like your brother, you're not like your sister. That's kind of, you know, that's the way it started from, like, grammar school. And, you know, you get to the point where you're like, well, why bother? And, you know, and and I always got blamed for stuff, whether I did it or not. So I started doing stuff. You know, I figured if I'm going to get in trouble for it, I might as well do it. And, you know, just, you know, things, you know, when I started stealing money when I was a young kid, you know, money was power, so I had power there. You know, I'd go to the candy store. This was back in the late 60s, and candy cost a penny, and I'd have a $20 bill. The candy store would call my mother, and then I got caught for stealing. But needless to say, these were my earliest memories. You know, I had my first beer when I was probably, 10. It was, you know, if I remember correctly, it was like New Year's Eve, and all the neighbors were over at the Gaffney's house, and they were celebrating. And me and Brian Gaffney, somehow he came up with a beer, and I split it with him. And that was our big New Year's celebration. He was a year older than I was. And then from there, you know, I didn't drink probably for another year and a half or so. When I was 11, my father died. He, you know, I went to school one morning. I came home. You know, we had early Wednesdays, so because I went to Catholic school, and they would bring the public school students into the school to get religious instruction on Wednesdays. I left in the morning, and I come walking down the street at about 12:45, and there's police cars all over the street. And, you know, I was like, oh, what's going on here? And, you know, I see Mae Gaffney peeking out the front door, and I can't walk in the front door. Meanwhile, she just closed it in my face, so I go walking around the back. And Ken, he, you know, he told me that Dad died and he was upstairs. And so that was traumatic, I guess. You know, at the time, I'm not even sure what I felt. You know, he wasn't the most gentle of dads. You know, there were a lot of beatings, a lot of, you know, being woken up in the middle of the night. There wasn't a holiday that a coffee cup wasn't broken or a fight wasn't happening. You know, I always thought it was, you know, Merry Christmas, slam, broken coffee cup. So I'm not even sure about my feelings about that at the time, but, it was a big funeral, big, you know, Irish wake, and, you know, and the thing I remember the most was that anyone's ever been to a funeral parlor in New York City, they're usually set up this way. They're set up, you have a funeral parlor, you have a bar next door, and you have OTB next to that, which is off-track betting. And I remember a lot of people coming up and smelling like booze. That I do remember. And so these people were obviously going in the bar and getting hammered, coming, oh, he was a great man, and, you know. And it was just one of those deals that, you know, I'm not even sure. That was in April. In May or June, my oldest brother, Colin, took me camping. Colin, by the way, has been in the program for 22 years. About 15 years ago, he sent me a birthday present that was a big book. I should have listened to him. I ended up, he took me camping. I don't know why, but he did. And when we were up there, we drank beer, and I drank, you know, probably 6 or 8 beers with him. And I remember just getting that, ease and comfort they always talk about, where, you know, I fell asleep in this raft, and we were in a whirlpool just spinning around gently in this lake. It was, you know, maybe that was my imagination, but that's what it was. You know, so then everybody I knew drank, and they didn't drink socially. I don't know anybody growing up in New York City that ever drank socially. You watched the way people drank. Everyone drank to get drunk. There was nothing social about it. The question was not, are you going out? Are you going to get drunk tonight? That was the question. So about 12 and 13 years old, we started, me and my buddies and, you know, the girls that we hung out with, we started getting older guys to buy beer and delis and things like that. And so we're smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and drinking Boone's Farm. And, Blackberry Brandy, you can't forget that. That was always a favorite. We were able to get, I don't know how we were able to get that, but we seemed to, you know, oh, it's wonder we have to have brandy. You know, we're 14 years old, for crying out loud. We don't need brandy for. And so I ended up, you know, we drank. And then I remember, I was probably 16 years old, and it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I got out of school, rough day. We were having a couple of quarts of beer in the park, and I didn't think anything of it. It was like a Tuesday or Wednesday. And my brother Ken comes home, and he's all pissed off at me. And he said, "What the hell were you drinking in the park for?" And I'm, you know, it's like, well, and then of course I lied about it. I wasn't drinking in the park. He goes, "Yes, you will. Let me smell your breath." And you know, I stunk like beer. We were drinking quarts or whatever. And so there was, you know, it was just normal to drink. It was just something everybody did. It was something to do. Let's go drinking. It was an adjective. It was a verb. You know, it was. And so we, you know, so with the. You know, we did. I drank a lot. When I was a sophomore in high school, I went to I went to one school the freshman year, and then I got kicked out. And so sophomore year, I went to a different school. And down the street, we were sophomores in high school, there was a bar, and they would serve us at lunchtime. We were drinking lowbrows, going back to school, and taking mescaline while we were at school. You know? And, you know, I was dressed very similar to the way I'm dressed today. You know, in the school, you had to wear a jacket and tie. You know, they knew where we were coming from. And when I was 15 years old, sucking down bars at lunchtime and going back to school. And it was a small classes. And I don't know how they didn't smell it. You know, and I, you know, somebody's drinking in here. I can smell it up here. And, you know, but they just didn't smell it. And so, you know, that's the way my drinking started. And then, you know, the goal was when you were 15 or 16, you could actually get into a bar called Mannion's. And that's where all the older people hung out. So, you know, that was, you know, the next step when I was 16, you know, there was a lot of drinking out in the streets, a lot of smoking pot, a lot of LSD. There was, you know, drugs in my story, and that's what it is. And I ended up, you know, just, you know, drinking in bars and getting into fights and being miserable. And, you know, I was... You know, and that's what I saw you did. You drank, you got into bar fights, you went home, you made up, and you did it again the next night. And, you know, so it was just the insanity of drinking in New York City. It was just, you know, everybody drank to get drunk. And, you know, there was nothing social about it. I remember walking around the corner, 8 o'clock in the morning, the guys would be sitting out there playing dominoes, and they'd be drinking quarts of beer. And it just seemed normal. It was all around you. So, you know, so there was, you know, and you know, the repercussions started happening early from drinking. You know, when I was 19, I got a DUI. This was like 1978. I got a slap on the wrist. Nothing ever happened about it. It was just one of those things. There were times where, you know, let me back up a second. Oh, and when I was 17, I got introduced to the magic stuff, cocaine. All of a sudden, I had something where I could drink all I want and stay up as long as I want and remember all I want. And I, you know, that was it. That was the perfect combination. I found that I went to Nirvana. I would do anything to get my hands on that stuff. And you got to remember, these, you know, it's 1977, where cocaine was pretty damn expensive back then. But we were buying it by the ounce. And so, yeah, you know. And yeah, you know, you know, I things like I, you know, we'd be partying in New York City. I'd wake up in Florida. You know, I'd have to look at the phone book to see what city I'm in. You know, I'd have one of those airplane flotation devices around my neck. It's like, ooh, this isn't good. You know, another time I was in we switched planes in Atlanta. We left the tickets in the folds and the seats in front of us in the plane. They just told us to get on the next plane. They just wanted us out of Atlanta. This is the type of stuff that, you know, started happening very early. It started happening very early. You know, I wasn't even 20 years old, and you know, I was out there traveling. It was, you know, we ended up in Canada one time, and, you know, somebody, a friend of mine, Mike Forning, you know, he got stabbed. And as opposed to taking him to hospital in Canada, because his health insurance doesn't work here, we drove him all the way back to New York City because, you know, don't ask me why. Poor guy stabbed, and we did. And we drank the whole way. You know, there was a car accident where driving off the Pocono Mountain, somebody lost their spleen. We won't go into those details, but it definitely, you know, is there's a lot of war stories before I was even 21. When I was 17, my mother died, and I still was in high school. I went to live with my brother, Ken, and that didn't work out well. You know, him and his wife were newlyweds, basically. They were like 25 years old, and I was 16 and 17 years old at the time. I was nothing but hell on wheels, and they kind of, you know, what happened was I was getting in so many fights with my brother, Colin, that he ended up kicking me in the head one time so hard that in the temple that I lost my sight and couldn't hear. And one of the neighbors told my brother that if he didn't take me, she was going to, because Colin was going to kill me. He was a very violent alcoholic, but I'm not here to tell his story. I'm here to tell mine. And that's, you know, there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of just, you know, you don't even tell the stories because people just think you're lying. I could probably tell them here because you people have heard all the stories. But yeah, and this by the time I was 17, you know, dad was dead, mom was dead. There was, you know, and all of a sudden I came into like $100,000. Well, you got a 17-year-old with a bad attitude and a lot of money that loves drugs and alcohol. You got a problem on your hands. I blew through that money pretty damn quick. Cars, motorcycles. You name it, going trips to Europe, you know, just blew right through it. Within 2 years, I was broke. You know, and I'm thinking, well, shit, I'm 20 years old. You know, I can make that money again. Not all in one block, though. So there was that. When I was in college was basically one major party after another. I barely remember it. You know, I remember North Avenue. I went to Iona College in New Rochelle. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in the bars on North Avenue, drinking a lot of, you know, a lot of time away. But that, to me, I was having a good time there. You know, I was mixing a lot of drugs and a lot of alcohol. I had the magic formula going for me. I don't know how things would happen. Like, you know, I'd have 4 flat tires on my car the next morning. Don't remember how it happened. I drive businesses and black out. I used to joke, oh, I must have driven home with my head in the passenger seat. And that has followed me my whole life. I basically got irritable, restful, and discontent when I was 21. I knew there was something west of the George Washington Bridge, and it wasn't New Jersey. I got in my car, I went on I-80, and I drove, and I drove, and I drove, and I ended up in California. And it was Sacramento I was in, and I said, this doesn't remind me of the movies that I saw about California. So I went south, and I hit the Mexican border, and I'm like, well, my Spanish isn't that good. So I hung out in San Diego for about a year. And not anything, when I went to California, I didn't know a soul, but guess what I was able to find very quick? Friends in bars. People that drank like I did, that did the things that I did, I fit right in. No realization that there might be a problem here. I just, you know, it was just, you know, I'm having a good time. I'm in my early 20s. I'm hanging out on the beaches. I'm drinking the way I want to drink. You know, doing the things I want to do. Isn't life grand? And the only problem with that plan was that, in my mind, San Diego was too small of a town because I was the ugly New Yorker. I compared everything to New York City. And, you know, this sucks, that sucks. You know, I can't believe I don't have this. What do you mean I can't have a 5-course meal at 4 o'clock in the morning? Can't everybody? And it was just one thing after another. So what happened was I decided to move to L.A. And I moved up to L.A., didn't know a soul, found the same exact people I was hanging out in San Diego, the same exact people I was hanging out in the Bronx with. It was, and I L.A. was too small of a town. And, you know, so it was one of those things. Then one day it dawned on me that New York was the exception and not the rule. And with that, I could live anywhere. So I stayed in California for a couple more years, and then I moved to Colorado. There's another geographic cure. You know, I didn't realize it at the time, but that's what these things were. My sister invited me out for Thanksgiving. You know, she knew I was, not doing very well. Karen is a big part of my life. She's always, you know, when after my dad died, her and I were like mutt and Jeff. You know, one of my jobs was to, you know, feed my mother. She'd make the food, things like that. And so she was like a surrogate mother. She's only 2 years older than I am. And so I went there for Thanksgiving. I showed up with a bag, you know, about this big, and I stayed for 20 years. Not at her house, but I stayed there for 20 years. And through that time, the same things kept happening. I wasn't even there a year, and it was Halloween, and I was driving home after doing the mall crawl. If anyone's ever out in Boulder, they know exactly what that is. And the cops, you know, I see the cops in my rearview mirror, right? But the guy in front of me pulls over, so I pull over with him. Well, the cops get out and talk to me and not him. Well, I thought they were pulling him over. And, you know, it was me that they were pulling over. That was, you know, DUI number two. Then, you know, it probably wasn't even 2 months later. DUI number three. DUI number four, a year later. Finally, the court said to me one time, the judge said to me, he said, you know, Mr. Moore, your driving record's not that bad except for these DUIs. Do you think you might have a drinking problem? Nope. I felt like I dealt with the consequences. You know, these were my consequences, and I dealt with them. And, you know, what does anyone care what I do? You know, little did I know, once again, it goes back to me, you know, blacking out, passing out, and driving. I felt I had this God-given right to drive whenever the hell I felt like it, no matter what condition I was in. And actually, up until recently, I still thought that. I ended up, same thing with Colorado. So after 20 years, I said, good. I said, I have a woman down in Atlanta. She's going to take care of me. Well, I get down here. It's December 2006. Christmas gets in the way. I couldn't find a job right away. Her sister gave me a copy of the AJC for like a Christmas present. I think she was telling me to get a job. But I stayed home and I drank. That's what I did. And so what happened was, finally she asked me, she said, can you not drink for a week? And I just got a job here that was a decent job. And she asked me that question. And guess what? I could not drink for a week. One day I came home, all my shit was packed. Her sister was saying, I'll take you wherever you want to go. I didn't know where to go. I knew how to go to work, to her house. This was in May of 2007, so I was here about 5 months. I just basically started my job in that April of 2007. I didn't have anybody at work I could talk to about it, you know. And so I ended up living on the hotel, the Holiday Inn on La Vista, for about a month until I found a place where I could figure out where I was and where work was. And I ended up renting a room. And when I rented this room, all I did was it was a place for me to sleep and drink. I went to work, I slept, I drank. I would get home every night, I would, stop at the liquor store, I would get shots of booze, and I would get an 18-pack or a 24-pack of beer. And I would drink that. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And on Sundays, because they couldn't just sell beer down here or alcohol, unless it was in a bar, I would go like to different bars around town. One of my favorites was Stroker's right up there on 78. I'd make it rain on Sundays. They loved me in there. And, and then in 2009, I got my last DUI. It was in DeKalb County. I was at a party that Microsoft was throwing at the Doubletree Hotel. I lived off of 78 and Coolidge, which is, North Lake turns into Coolidge. And I don't know how I ended up on Claremont and North Druid Hills, but I did. The cops pulled me over. I don't even remember being arrested, right? When I got up in the morning, when I finally came to in the morning, everybody in the holding cell knew my name. It was just one of those things. I just don't even remember it. I don't know why I was going that way. I was, and you would think that would get me to stop drinking, but it didn't. I ended up, drinking for a couple more years. And then, finally, I lost my job. In June of 2010, I lost my job. And I was drinking, actually, in May of 2010, I was drinking. I called my sister Karen in Colorado. I said, I'm turning into Mom. And she knew exactly what I meant. That all I wanted to do was drink. I didn't know what to do. I was contemplating suicide at this point. She was so concerned. She called the Georgia Crisis Line and the CAF Fire Department. CAF Fire Department wakes me up. It's like seven of them in my room. It's like, what the hell are you guys doing here? Well, your sister from Colorado called us. And I was like, damn that girl. She's good. So I ended up actually going to DeKalb Medical Center. And here goes the difference. Great. So I go to DeKalb Medical Center, and The place was like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I don't know if anyone's been there, behavioral science unit. Right? It was unbelievable. And I knew nothing of AA, didn't know anything about it. So what they did was I got there like on a Wednesday or something like that. They talked my way out of there 10 o'clock on a Friday night. They sent me home with a prescription. That was it. There was no plan. I ended up, went home. There was booze stored at home. I just started, right off, well, I'm feeling better now. They gave me a shot of Ativan and all these couple of pills, and I feel good. And I started up right again. And then finally, about 3 weeks later, I ended up checking myself into Peachford. My sister called around. She actually found a halfway house. The halfway house said, no, we can't detox them. Call these people. And so when I went there, I remember sitting outside smoking cigarettes and saying, how is this going to change my life? I said, it probably is not going to. I didn't know you could smoke in Peachford. I smoked all my cigarettes. And when I went to Peachford, I had a really hard detox. I drank for a long time. I'm talking about hard drinking for probably, 20 to 30 years without ever really detoxing. I couldn't hold a cup in my hand. People had to pour juice into the container for me. They were giving me 20 milligrams of Valium, and I was still shaking like a leaf. I don't remember exactly, what went on there. But when I left, I was picked up by these people that I didn't know. And this is something my sister arranged. And I was taken off because I couldn't go home. If I would have gone home, I would have started drinking again. And they all realized that except me. I'm like, well, I got to, I'm going to do this. I got to move. I got to get my car. I had a million excuses why I can't do this. I ended up staying in a halfway house. And one thing the halfway house did for me was they took me to a lot of meetings. I got a lot of different flavors of different ice creams, and I, some of them I like, some of them I don't. I spent a lot of time sleeping in meetings. When I first got sober, I could not stay awake. It was just one of those things. My mind was just, healing itself. But finally, after, a month or whatever, I started listening. I started hearing bits and pieces of it, and I started hearing my story. And, with that, when I started listening, I started, getting better. It was miraculous that I got better. I started feeling better. I was thinking better. I was thinking better. I didn't tell you how I looked. I had no teeth and broken glasses. That's how, and I thought that was acceptable. I really did. That's where I got to the point in my life where I thought that was acceptable. In the halfway house, that was, what they did something very well, and what I needed was triage. That's what halfway houses do very well, is they do triage. I needed to be stabilized. I needed a place where I knew I was going to have food on a regular basis. I knew I was going to have a bed over my head, and I knew that I was going to, that I wasn't going to be able to left up to my own devices and then drink. And that worked very well. The halfway house ended up taking me to different meetings, as I said. I was at the Peachford Hospital on the Wednesday night panel meeting, and there was a gentleman up there, and he told something, a story that I could not believe. Talked about how his son died while he was fishing, and how, he was there, and he couldn't save him. And he didn't drink. And I was like, damn, if that guy can't drink with that, how, what in my life do I have to worry, that even comes close to that. And I started working with this guy, and he got me through, through halfway through my fourth step, and then he had to move. But right away, I got another sponsor. And I was in the perfect storm. At this point, I left the halfway house. I was living in transitional housing, we'll use that term. It's not even a halfway house, or three-quarter house. If you want to stay sober in there, you can. A lot, and if you don't, you can do whatever you want. A lot of people die in these places. But I stayed, and I got a new sponsor. And he finished up taking me through my fourth step. He picked up right where my other sponsor left off. And he worked closely with me. And I did the fourth and fifth step. And I told that man things I never told him before in my life. Or I told anyone in my life, things I wouldn't even admit to myself. And then I started getting involved. I started getting involved in a home group. I started getting involved in the fellowship. I can tell you this day, when I first started hanging out at my home group, I remember I would stand outside the group of guys that I hang out with now because I didn't feel like I was part of them. But over time, it wasn't them. It wasn't that they weren't inviting. It was that I wasn't joining. I started, getting involved, with the group, and I started showing up and suiting up, and I completed my steps. And and then when my sponsor told me it was time to start working with other sponsees, You know, he said, pray over it. And I did a lot of praying. And he taught me how to pray. And he showed me how to pray. And God came into my life when I was doing those steps. And I learned that there is something greater than myself. You know, I always looked at it, who am I hurting? I haven't killed anybody. What are they all so upset for? I ended up, you know, sponsoring people. And, you know, and ironically, I haven't been very successful at it, and it's not that I'm not trying, and they're not staying. You know, it proves to me that I can't get anyone sober, and I can't get them drunk. All I can do is do what was done for me and take them to the books of Alcoholics Anonymous, show them, you know, this is what you know this means, and this is how it was explained to me, and I'm here. I'm here to coach you. I'm here to be your friend. I'm here to be. You know, a sounding board. You know, we all get these great ideas in our heads, and by sponsoring people, you know, a lot of it is for my own good. Because if I'm verbalizing something to them, it's like, oh, wait a minute, that applies to me too. You know, I stick with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to meetings pretty much, you know, 7 days a week. I go to big book studies. I go to open discussion meetings. I go to treatment meetings where the suffering alcoholic is. I've learned to be a member of AA. This is something that is totally not my, you know, my natural instincts is not to be a member of AA. My natural instinct is to be the first part of the AA, an alcoholic. It's the second part that keeps me sober, or makes me different. So I work with guys, and then I had a life lesson, you know, somebody I was working with very closely just this past, you know, in the last few months, and you know, he took his will back, and this one really bothered me, I talked to my sponsor about it, and his response to me was, well, if it bothers you too much, you're going to have to go to Al-Anon. But you know, what it gave me out of that was that I saw how I affected people when I didn't think I was affecting anybody and how they felt. Yeah, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't costing them money, it wasn't costing them going to jail, it wasn't costing them cars, it wasn't costing them whatever. But it cost that pain, which is probably the biggest pain that I felt it this weekend, and it was real. And I prayed over it, and I think it was a good life lesson for me. Well, I'm almost out of time here. I'm going to close with this. You know, there's a couple of things that I learned in this program, you know. One, that the 12 steps work. They really do. Two, that God is real. And three, I need all of you to stay sober. Thank you and good night. My mind wants to cry out loud. Oh.